Bonjour. Bonne année. Welcome to this press briefing for today, Friday, the 10th of January. To the delight of some and possibly to the chagrin of some others, it's a relatively light briefing schedule this morning. I think we're going to start with Pascal, who's kindly agreed to come here in person, and he's got a couple of updates as well as, a statement and announcement. So go ahead, Pascal.
Merci, Michele. Bonne année. Happy New Year to you all. The UN Human Rights Council began this week its 19th cycle under the new presidency of Ambassador Jörg Lauber of Switzerland with an organizational meeting on the Universal Periodic Review. As a reminder, a total of 42 states will have their human rights records reviewed this year through the UPR mechanism. A full list of these 42 states under review is available on the Human Rights Council website. And the upcoming UPR session, the 48th session, will begin on the 20th of January. I also have a programming note for this coming week. The Intergovernmental Working Group on the Durban Declaration and Plan of Action will hold its 23rd session in Geneva from the 13th to the 17th of January. Most of the discussion of this working group will be on the draft UN Declaration on the respect, protection, and fulfillment of the human rights of people of African descent. The meeting will be held in room 17 of the Palais and will not be webcast, but this is a public meeting. And sorry, I've been running to the press briefing room. I also have two short media statements from two investigative bodies that were established by the Human Rights Council. These statements were issued yesterday afternoon. The Independent International Fact-Finding Mission on Venezuela condemned the recent arrest in the country ahead of the presidential inauguration scheduled today. The fact-finding mission said that these recent arrests, including those of prominent human rights defenders, political leaders, and their relatives, constitute yet another attack on the rights and freedom of the Venezuelan people. On Tuesday and Wednesday of this week, the mission has registered 16 arrests or apprehensions in various states across the country, targeting political leaders, human rights defenders, and even relatives of opposition figures. The fact-finding mission urgently calls for the immediate disclosure of the whereabouts of the individual arrested, ensuring that they are safeguarded and protected by law. It also calls for all arbitrarily detained individuals to be released immediately and unconditionally. I have another statement from the Commission of Inquiry on Syria. Mr. Ani Megali, one of the three commissioners of the Commission of Inquiry on Syria, concluded yesterday its first visit to Damascus. Mr. Megali led a team of this commission that was established by the Human Rights Council in 2011, and he held meeting with government officials, including the Ministry of Justice and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Discussions covered justice for victims and families, the protection of mass graves and evidence, and continued engagement with the commission. Mr. Megali welcomed the willingness of the new authorities to continue engaging with the commission on its future visits. And Mr. Megali said that he was in one of these detention centers that he visited, and he said, I quote, standing in tiny windowless cells still filled with stench and marked by suffering was a stark reminder of the harrowing accounts the commission has documented over nearly 14 years of investigations. He added that these abuses must never be repeated again and that those responsible must be held accountable. Both the Commission of Inquiry on Syria and the fact-finding mission on Venezuela will present updated reports to the 50th session of the Human Rights Council this spring in March. If you have any follow-up questions, please contact Todd Pittman for Venezuela and Johan Eriksson for Syria. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Pascal. Any questions for him?
Yes, I have one.
I see two online, but let's go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. Good morning. Thank you very much for taking my question, Michael. Pascal, my question is regarding the new president, the incoming president, Ambassador Jörg Glober. Is he going to be speaking here, informing us about his program of work for 2025? And then the other question is related to actual this Meta, Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg has declared that they would stop moderating their sites, which reach billions of people, and that therefore will create even more confusion in the information, global information ecosystem, if the High Commissioner will have a statement regarding that decision.
Okay, yes, Ambassador Jörg Glober will brief the press prior to the start of the 58th session. That will begin on the 24th of February. So his press conference is usually scheduled on the Wednesday before the session starts. That will most likely be the morning of the 19th of February, but we'll confirm that with you a bit later. Regarding your second question, I mean, it's a question addressed to the High Commissioner or the Human Rights Office. I think you're better. It's better for you to contact Ravina's team on this regard.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions online. We'll go to Nick, Catherine, and then I see Yuri in the room. So Nick, go ahead.
Thanks. And hi, Pascal. I just wanted to check in relation to the COIA visit to Syria, was Hani Magali the only commissioner on the trip? Who else was in the team? And has there been any move to establish a permanent kind of base for the commission researchers or secretariat staff in Syria? Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. Yes, I can confirm that Hani Magali was the only of the three commissioners who undertook this visit to Damascus. I don't have the specific details about how big his team was, but as you probably remember earlier this year, another expert team of the COI did a preliminary visit to the country. As far as how big or how permanent the presence of the commission will be in Syria, that's still something to be determined. But for sure, Mr. Magali welcomed the engagement of the new caretaker government with the commission, something that hasn't happened with the previous government over the past 14 years.
Thank you, Pascal. Catherine Franco.
Yes, good morning, Michele, and good morning, Pascal. Best wishes to both of you for this new year. In fact, my question is related to human rights, but not for Pascal at the Council, but is there anyone from the Human Rights Office? It's related to Syria, and my question is about the involvement of foreign fighters in Syria. And apparently, the new authorities have given foreign fighters high positions in certain cities like Tartus, Latakia, and other cities. It's reported by people living there that you have foreigners that are in fact organizing and heading those cities. Is there any comment from the Office of the High Commissioner on that question, please?
Thank you, Catherine. We've seen those same reports. I don't have anybody online from the Office of the High Commissioner today. I expect that that's because they're not briefing proactively, but I think that if you're looking for a response to that particular question, we could either forward it or you can perhaps contact them directly. Thank you so much. I think I have Yuri next. Go ahead.
Bonjour Pascal et bonne année. Il est peut-être juste un peu tôt, mais pour la semaine de haut niveau pour l'ouverture du Conseil des droits de l'homme et l'ouverture de la conférence du désarmement, est-ce que tu as déjà un début de liste de ministres qui doivent participer ou au moins une compréhension de si on doit en attendre beaucoup ou pas ? Merci.
Bah écoute, merci Yuri, j'ai posé cette question à mes collègues hier. Comme tu peux l'imaginer, il est encore trop tôt pour connaître les noms des dignitaires qui viendront au segment de haut niveau. Tout ce que je peux te dire, c'est que ce segment de haut niveau est prévu pour 3 jours, donc du lundi 24 au mercredi 26 février inclus. Mais dès qu'on aura plus de détails, on partagera ces informations avec vous.
Merci Pascal, Agnès et puis Gabriela. Agnès.
Hi there. I have a question, but it's not on the Human Rights Council, so I don't know if I can ask it now. It's about Sudan.
Well, you know, go ahead and we'll see what we can do with it.
Okay, thank you. It's a question to UNICEF. I think James is listening, and it could be also for Rocha, but I don't think they are listening. So I was wondering if he could give us a little update of the situation there, and in particular about the Adre border, to know how many trucks are going into that border. And given it's open, is there a possibility for the UN to increase the aid coming to the people in Darfur, given the last report saying that famine is increasing in that region? Thank you.
Thank you, Agnes. James, I don't know if you're listening in, and if you can come in on that. Over. Maybe not. Maybe we'll take a pass on that one and see if James can connect with us again later on. Gabriela, I have a question from you. Hopefully,
yes,
for people in present.
Yeah, Pascal. Sorry, I was a little bit late. And you were talking about a mission that is going to Syria. Is Mrs. Carla Quintana going in this group or not? And I don't know if she's coming to Geneva to talk to us, because I think that the issue of disappearances is such a big thing in Syria. I don't know if you have any numbers, any estimate of how many people have been disappeared since the manifestations, the protests. Thank you.
Well, I don't have the exact figures with me, but I can certainly double check the figures that this Commission of Inquiry has accumulated over the 14 years of its mandate. When it comes to the Independent Institution on Missing Persons, as you know, this is another mechanism that does not report to the Human Rights Council. We have a new communication colleague who's in charge of this institution, and we'll be happy to put you in touch with her. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Any more questions for Pascal? If not, I think you're off the hook. Okay, merci. Coming up next, we've got Claire Nullis, our colleague from the World Meteorological Organization, and she's got an important announcement regarding the release of some figures on global temperatures, which is happening later today.
Yes, thank you. The World Meteorological Organization will later today confirm that 2024 was the hottest year on record. We saw extraordinary land and sea surface temperatures, extraordinary ocean heat, accompanied by, as we all know, very extreme weather affecting many countries around the world, destroying lives, livelihoods, hopes, and dreams. We saw many climate change impacts, retreating sea ice, glaciers. It was an extraordinary year. We will be issuing a press release at 5 p.m. I know this is very, very late for European times. The reason for this is that the World Meteorological Organization, our consolidated global figure, is based on 6 international data sets. These are from the European Copernicus Climate Change Service, the UK's Met Office, both of which have already released their findings earlier this morning. Additionally, it's based on the US National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and NASA data sets. Those two will be released later today at 5 p.m., which is why we can't release the consolidated figure for as long as those two individual, you know, data sets are not publicly available. In addition to that, we use data from Berkeley Earth, which is US-based, and from the Japan Meteorological Organization. In addition, this year, as you will see with the press release, when it comes out, we will be incorporating data from an ocean consortium, which is led by a group within the Chinese Academy of Sciences, which has got very, very important findings on ocean heat and sea surface temperatures. That's all I can really say for now, because, you know, it is under embargo. But obviously, at COP29 in Baku in November, WMO did back then say that 2024 was on track to be the warmest on record, and that will be confirmed today. I also have, given that it's quite a short briefing, if you want, I can also say something on the California fires, but perhaps we can have questions first on
absolutely.
On global temperatures.
I think that would be great. But I see we have a question online from Jeremy Lange, so I would like to give the floor to him and see. I assume this is for Claire. Jeremy?
Yes, it is. Thank you, Michele. Hi, Claire. Just to understand, I know you can't say much, and I guess that we can't have the thing as an embargo before five. The question is how different the figures will be tonight at 5 p.m. compared to what Copernicus said this morning. I mean, compared to the 1.6 that was published, like, you know, anything different from there?
It's small but significant differences, and especially, you know, given all the interest around, you know, the 1.5 figure, it's not a magic figure, but there is obviously a lot of interest around that, and this is the importance of the WMO figures, which do combine the different data sets. Four of the data sets that we used are based on sort of traditional observations. Two of them are based on what we call reanalysis. So that's sort of computer, computer generated. Copernicus is one of the reanalysis data sets, and they tend to come out a little bit warmer than the others. So it's not a huge difference, but, you know, we're scientists. We have to be accurate. We have to get it right. And there's been a great deal of internal discussion at WMO in the past few days about, you know, calculating and interpreting these different data sets. But I think that, you know, the one thing that we need to underline is that all the data sets are, you know, quite clear. We are heading in the wrong direction. And as our Secretary General stressed in Baku at COP and in subsequent interviews, even if 1 year, one calendar year, or even if one calendar month does go above 1.5 degrees above the pre-industrial baseline, it does not mean that the Paris Agreement is dead. That, you know, there is an important difference in that.
Thank you, Claire. So I've got Isabel, Christophe, and then I'm sorry, I've got Gabriela, then Christophe, and then Isabel online. Gabriela, go ahead.
Thank you, Claire. Happy New Year to you. I don't know, maybe I'm not correct, but last year you said that it was the warmest year. So what is happening? Each year is warmest and year record? Each year is a record? What is happening there? Thank you.
Different things. There is long-term global warming. That is a very clear, long-term signal. So 2023 was the warmest on record by quite a large margin. what we've seen in 2024. What we saw the latter part of 2023 and the early part of 24 was we had an El Nino event. El Nino, you know, adds additional heat to the atmosphere. So you know, El Nino definitely played a role. It does not mean that every single year, you know, from now on is going to set a new temperature record, because we do have to factor in, you know, naturally occurring climate variability. But the long term trend is definitely in the wrong direction. It's upwards.
Christophe.
Thanks for taking my question. It's about the 1.5 and what you just said about the Paris Accord is not out of the window. It's a bit confusing because Copernicus, for example, gives an average over 2 years and it's over 1.5. So could you just tell us again, at what point will we consider that, you know, Paris is dead?
Is the subject of obviously a lot of discussion, many studies. There is no exact definition within the Paris Agreement, but it is interpreted as over a baseline of several decades, at least two decades. So, you know, 1 or 2 years, it's a clear warning signal. Even 1 year is a warning signal. Even 1 month is a warning signal. But we, you know, we have to have a much, much longer term average. And there are, you know, a great deal of scientific studies on that. And indeed, the World Meteorological Organization has set up an expert working group to look at precisely that issue.
Thank you, Claire. I think we had, I don't see Isabel anymore, but I see Jeremy with his hand up. I think that's a new hand.
It is, yes, thanks. You mentioned La Nino, Claire, and I was wondering how concerned are you at WMO that La Nina didn't really show up so far, or very little, let's say, and could this be, could 2025 be a turning point if La Nina is not showing up and we end up with another record at the end of the year? Is that a major fear for you?
So at the end of 2023, the start of 2024, we had El Nino, which is the warming phase. Our last update, which I think was released early December, said that I think it was a sort of 50% chance of La Nina, which is the cooling side of the, you know, of the equation. And I see that overnight, the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, they did actually declare a La Nina event. We at WMO, we haven't done that yet. It takes us a little bit more time. And the reason is that when we declare an El Nino or La Nina, it's what we call a consensus statement. So that's based on different global models from around the world. A lot of expert opinion, which takes us, you know, which is why it takes us a little bit longer to do so. Not all the models always agree. You know, sometimes there are differing interpretations on the oceanic component of it, sometimes differing interpretations on the atmospheric component. So, but as I said, NOAA overnight did declare a La Nina event, and I'm not aware that there is any evidence so far to say that because of climate change we will no longer see La Nina. What we would say is that, you know, the long-term warming signal from human activities, from greenhouse gases, is, you know, just as strong as if not stronger than any signal from El Nino and La Nina.
Thank you, Claire. You probably all saw that yesterday. Oh, pardon, Christophe, go ahead. One more.
No, it's just about, you were going to talk about the Los Angeles fires. So
that's right. We're
please
moving.
Feel free
we're transitioning to that.
To
you saw that. Probably that the Secretary General issued a statement yesterday expressing his shock and sadness at the widespread devastation caused by the wildfires in Los Angeles. On this, I just wanted to invite Claire to tell us a few things from the WMO side.
And obviously, from the perspective of the World Meteorological Organization, we extend the condolences of the UN Secretary General. It's a terrible, terrible tragedy for everybody concerned. It's terrible news for health, for air quality, and obviously for people's lives and ecosystems and the local economy. To give you some context on this, California is no stranger to wildfires. You know, we do see them regularly. This event is extraordinary in that it's impacting one of the largest cities in the United States, and obviously it's made media headlines because of the nature of the properties you know, that have been destroyed. The U.S. National Weather Service and the Los Angeles branch has a high-end, sort of upper-end red flag warning in effect through Friday morning local time in parts of Los Angeles and Ventura counties. And it says, due to strong winds, there will be increased risk of rapid fire spread and extreme fire behavior in some areas, not all areas, I hasten to add. In some parts of Los Angeles, winds are weakening. It's not the role of WMO to issue forecasts. You know, that is the role of the National Weather Service, and in particular in Los Angeles. But it is just to give you an idea. Why is this happening? Last year's rainy season for the Los Angeles area as a whole was you know, slightly above normal, if anything. But from, you know, late 2024 until now, it's been below normal. And the big compounding factor, so you've got dry soils, low humidity. The big compounding factor in this is the winds. It's a well-known weather pattern in California. It's quite local, called the Santa Ana winds. And they typically occur in this region. They're high winds from the mountains. They cause temperatures to rise, and they cause very low humidity, drying out the ground and vegetation. If you look at a map of the U.S., it's almost a tale of two countries. You know, the headlines earlier this week were of the terrible winter storms, which have affected a lot of the U.S. and continue to affect parts of the U.S. But then, obviously, you've got that quite small area, which is, you know, absolutely devastating losses. The question that we always get is, what about climate change? Weather here is playing a big role. I need to stress, you know, it's the winds and it's the dry soils. Causes of wildfires are manifold, and I'm not sure that the causes of these various fires have been ascertained yet. Quite often, sometimes it is unfortunately a human factor, but you do need the high winds and the dry soils to propagate them. So the role of climate change, and here I am quoting verbatim from the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. They are the experts on California, not WMO. So this is to quote NOAA. Climate change, including increased heat, extended drought, and a thirsty atmosphere, have been a key driver in increasing the heat and extent of wildfires in the western United States during the last two decades. So this is a general statement. It's not specifically about these particular wildfires, but it is a general climate change statement. Wildfires require the alignment of a number of factors, including temperature, humidity, and the lack of moisture in fuels such as trees, shrubs, grasses, and forest debris. All these factors have a strong direct or indirect ties to climate variability, so that's the natural variations such as El Niño, La Niña, and climate change. A 2016 study, and again we're quoting NOAA, found climate change enhanced the drying of organic matter and doubled the number of large fires between 1984 and 2015 in the western United States. We're not talking about the whole of the US. And a 2021 study supported by NOAA concluded that climate change has been the main driver of the increase in fire weather, and I stress fire weather, in the western US. Obviously, a lot of other factors, land management, build, you know, where people build their houses, the clearing of forests. But it does, you know, underline, you know, we do need effective early warning systems. Unfortunately, there have been a number of fatalities during these fires, but there have been very, very effective early warnings, a lot of evacuations. That doesn't diminish the, you know, the tragedy to people who've lost their properties, but, you know, hopefully it has saved lives. And without wanting to put her in the spot, Margaret is sitting in the room if you need anything on health aspects of this.
We see her. We've got Christophe and then Gabriela. Go ahead, Christophe.
In 10 days, we have a new president of the United States taking charge during the investiture. But so I was just wondering, like, given that he's very skeptical, to say the least, about climate change, you know, what is your message?
I think that's probably a little bit above my pay grade. I think these fires, you know, we're going to be talking about the economic cost of these fires is going to be in, you know, multiple billion dollars. The US has suffered a number of what they call classes billion-dollar disasters in the past year. Obviously, not every single weather-related disaster is due to climate change. You know, nobody would say that. But we do get, you know, quite clear signals that climate change is exacerbating some of these disasters, making, you know, rainfall heavier in certain tropical cyclone systems, in certain parts, you know, increasing heat waves.
Thank you very much. We have Gabriela and then we have Lisa Schlein online. Gabriela, go ahead.
Thank you, Michele. I saw some videos in Twitter showing that the fire started at the same time in three different points, as if it had been an arson fire. Then months before, the owners of the houses were left without insurance, and there were some irregularities. Have you seen these accusations, or do you think it could be possible that? Thank you.
That's obviously not for WMO to comment on. That is a matter for, you know, the local authorities to investigate. You know, all we can say, you know, from the National Weather Service is that, you know, the conditions for the rapid spread of fires are there. You know, these very high winds and the low soil moisture. As we've seen in, you know, in previous examples, you know, fires can be started by a dropped cigarette. They can be started, unfortunately, deliberately. They can be started by a car backfiring. They can be started by lightning. There are a lot of different causes, and that really is for the local authorities to ascertain. So we can't comment on that.
Lisa, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Michele, and Happy New Year to you all. Hi, Claire, I've got a couple of questions for you. First of all, President-elect Donald Trump blames California Governor Gavin Newsom for the disaster, saying that it's bad management, his bad management, which is the cause. Is that a possibility? Also, are there actions that can be taken or should be taken in anticipation of a natural disaster such as this? Or is this something that's just impossible to deal with because of the enormity of the catastrophe? And then, yes, indeed, your suggestion about Margaret Harris being there is wonderful. I would very much be interested in having her take on the health impacts of the toxic fumes which are roiling around the city. Thank you.
Sorry, Margaret. So on the first question, it's not the role of WMO to get involved in internal politics within the US, so I don't comment on that. In terms of what can we do, yes, prevention does, you know, is very important, and so this comes down to, you know, land management, building regulations, regular clearing of underbrush in forests so that there's, you know, less fuel for the fires, evacuation plans. One of my colleagues who, you know, who's familiar with California said he was struck by the TV images, just, you know, the number of cars which were blocking the evacuation routes. So again, you know, that is a local issue. But as I said, I think as WMO, our underlining message would be that, you know, once again, it does highlight the importance of early warnings. The warnings have, in this instance, been, you know, been very, very good. You know, people have been evacuated. It's been impossible to save houses, but, you know, loss of life still too high, but it has been kept to a relative minimum. Over to Margaret.
Thanks very much, and thanks, Lisa, for the question. It's an important one. I mean, straight out, wildfires can have significant morbidity and mortality simply because they burn you, especially if you do not get the opportunity or do not heed evacuation orders. But the wildfire smoke that you asked specifically about is indeed a mixture of air pollutants, of which particulate matter is the one that is of major concern. It can be full of PM 2.5, which is a very small particulate matter that can get right down into the lungs. And there's certainly a lot of... it is associated with premature death in the general population and can cause exacerbate diseases of lung, heart, brain, nervous system, skin, gut, kidney, eyes, nose and liver. And it's also been shown to lead to cognitive impairment, so actually damage your intellectual capacity and to memory loss. And of course, firefighters and emergency response workers are greatly impacted by the risk of exposure to smoke and of course to injuries, burns and smoke inhalation.
Thank you, Lisa. Is your hand still up? Okay.
It's an old hand. Here we go. I mean, a new one. Claire, earlier you mentioned that the economic impact will be enormous. Do you have any idea about how much this could possibly amount to, and perhaps you too, Margaret, in terms of the economic aspect of the health conditions, and are illnesses which might occur from this, would they be of a temporary order or long lasting? Or I imagine that there are some people who have chronic illnesses that would suffer the most, and perhaps this could be a deadly situation for them. Thanks.
So on the first question, on the economic impact, again, that's not for WMO. The US has a great deal of expertise in this. Every month, the US National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration issues a chart with its monthly climate update. And that includes a sort of a running tally of what they call billion-dollar disasters. So this definitely will be a billion-dollar disaster, but it's, you know, it's for the U.S. authorities to, once this tragedy, you know, is over, it's still ongoing, you know, they will do the assessments.
Thanks, Lisa. And it's an important question because really what we need is more interdisciplinary research to understand the long-term effects, because there are indeed concerns about the latent and long-term health effects of wildfire exposure on vulnerable populations, particularly children, older people, pregnant people, and chronically ill people. So particularly in geographic areas that we expect we'll see this over and over again if we don't get what we're doing to the planet under control.
Thank you very much, Margaret. And Claire, I'm going to just look quickly and see whether we have any further questions for you. Okay, so you've got... Yeah, no, go ahead. You've got a question, and then I think possibly Maya, and then we've got Claire wanting to make an additional comment.
So sorry, Michele. No, I have a question on another issue.
Okay. Well, then let's go to Maya then. And
yes, thank you very much for taking my question. Happy New Year, Claire and Margaret. And my question is related to the question of insurance companies. Do they work or draw on the work of the WMO in order to understand what risks there are? Because probably the amount of insurance costs will be enormous now that we see more and more events like that. As you mentioned, that's perhaps not related to climate change, this particular fire in California, but still, how do we see and how do you work and how much insurance companies come to you to assess risk?
I'm not aware that we have many direct contacts with insurance companies, but obviously the data is publicly available, so they can consult it. We do have some links with the reinsurance groupings. It tends to be the groupings rather than the individual companies. But as I said, the data is there, and it's fire weather is becoming an increasing risk in many parts of the world. If I could just briefly go from fire to ice, next week you should have received a media advisory on it. We will be having a sort of background in-depth briefing with experts about glaciers. This year is the International Year of the Preservation of Glaciers. It will be officially launched at WMO on the 21st of January, but ahead of that on the 16th, we're organizing an online sort of technical briefing, with some experts just to, give journalists chance to, to ask more detailed questions ahead of that, the launch. The launch itself, we're not planning a press conference here at the UN. Just it's Tuesday. It's a briefing day, and people coming in for the event, they've got travel constraints. But if there are requests for interviews with any of the experts there or the speakers, contact me and I'll facilitate it.
Thank you very much, Claire. Indeed, very interesting and very topical issue. I've got, Christophe, I see a hand up from Catherine as well. Christophe, go ahead.
Yes, before Margaret and Claire go away, I had a question. The High Commissioner for Human Rights just issued a tweet or a message on X about regulation of heinous messages and saying this is not censorship. So my question is, what's the UN, or how is the UN thinking about their presence on social networks, given the decisions that have been announced this week by Meta, Elon Musk's behavior? Is the UN and the different agencies, are you planning to change your policy on where you publish your messages? Thank you.
Well, maybe I can address that briefly on behalf of the UN. I think that, we're constantly watching this space and evaluating it. Up till now, our posture has been that, it's important for us to be present with fact-based, information. And this is what we advocate for. How this will evolve, right, is we don't know yet, but clearly we're seeing that there are some different actors, in the international cooperation space that are taking different measures in terms of, but for us at present, we're still believe that it's important to be there on those platforms. to present information that is evidence based. But I don't know if I want to add something to that.
Very much the same. I mean, our role is to provide good science based health information, and we need to provide that wherever people are looking for it. So we are being across all platforms whenever possible.
Oh, there's a question from Catherine Fiancant, fire or ice or something else?
Yes, thank you, Michele. Two questions, one for Claire, one for Margaret. Claire, according to the program regarding the glaciers, it's taking place on the 16th from 1 p.m. till 3 p.m., 2 hours? Is it correct?
Yes, it's my colleague, Brigitte Perrin, she's actually organizing it. It's a detailed technical briefing, so it's really, for journalists who want to discover and discuss, this issue in greater detail than would normally be allowed for in, just when we sit on the podium here for 20 minutes, half an hour. But obviously, it's not the official launch. It really is just to give you different perspectives on, the importance of glaciers, what's happening in the cryosphere. So it's probably not going to be, it won't be giving you headline news, but it is more, just an in-depth briefing for greater understanding. But as I said, if you've got additional questions, ask Brigitte on that.
You had a question for Margaret as well. Catherine, did we lose you?
Yes. Okay. I needed to be reactivated. So, Margaret, good morning. My question is related to the nomination of the regional director of WHO Afro. We know that Dr. Faustine Ndugulile passed away, and I'd like to know what is now the mechanism. When I asked the question to Dr. Tedros in December, he mentioned that a meeting was going to take place in December about it. So there has been no follow-up about that. Could you please give us some details about what's going to happen? Thank you, Margaret.
Yes, there is a process now in place. I'm just checking my email because I got something from our legal department about the nature of the process. It's going to happen this month. I think next week they will begin. I'll send you by email, or I can send it to everybody, what exactly the process is.
Thank you.
Thank you. Not only the process, but how is it going to be? Are the former candidates going to run again? Will you allow the new candidates to be part of the race, or how is it, would it be possible to send it out as soon as possible if it takes place next week? Thank you, Margaret.
I will send it out as soon as possible. I didn't have that level of detail from memory. I'm just quickly scanning through my emails to see if I've got it easily, but I don't. But I will send out what we have. And it was only a short amount that I think that they were beginning the process to look at exactly what to do. But I will give you the exact detail when I find it.
Thank you very much, Margaret. Any more questions for Claire or Margaret? We were expecting James Elder to connect from UNICEF, so just my apologies. It seems like he wasn't able to, so perhaps, and yes, if you're still online, you can just forward your question to him on Syria, and I'm sure he'll respond when he has a moment. I do not see anything further online. Thank you very much, both of you, for being here, and I've got just a couple of quick announcements to make. So we'll start with the Committee on the Rights of the Child, which opens next Monday morning, 10 a.m., so the 13th of January at Palais Wilson. It runs until the 31st of January, and it will review the reports of Slovakia, Eritrea, Honduras, St. Kitts and Nevis, Peru, Gambia, Ecuador, And after that, there will be also a meeting of the committee with member states. In addition, but on a separate topic, I have a note here that to say that the UN is accepting nominations for the 2025 United Nations Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela Prize. There is a deadline for nominations, which is the 28th of February. The prize is given out only every 5 years and acknowledges individuals who dedicate their lives to the service of humanity, that promote the purposes and principles of the UN and honors Nelson Mandela's legacy of reconciliation, political transition, and social transformation. Importantly, UN staff cannot nominate or be nominated for this prize. And just for your information, two individuals who've previously, there are two individuals, a man and a woman from different geographic regions who will be selected by a UN committee chaired by the President of the General Assembly. Previous laureates in 2020 include Mariana Vardinoyannis, who is a Greek philanthropist and a world advocate for human rights and the protection of children, and Morisanda Kuyate, a leading advocate from Guinea on ending violence against women and girls in Africa. The first awardee of this prize in 2025 was Dr. Helena Ndumbe of Namibia, who is an ophthalmologist whose life's work has been the treatment of blindness and eye-related illnesses in our country, as well as former president of Portugal, Jorge Fernando Branco Sampaio, who was a leader in a struggle for restoration of democracy in his country. So there are some links if you're interested. Again, nominations, deadline, 28th of February, 2025. Gabriela.
Thank you, Michele. I have a question. Maybe I'm not correct, but until now I have not seen any statement from the Secretary General or the High Commissioner for Human Rights about what is happening in Venezuela. Yesterday, the Maduro government imprisoned the opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado. Then they liberate her, and Maduro threatens to arrest the elected President Edmundo González the moment he arrives in Venezuela for the inauguration. So my question is, why the silence of the UN, or if Mr. Guterres is going to have to say a statement about this, or the High Commissioner, Volker Turk, or someone? Thank you.
Well, normally we would expect something to come in the area of the human rights space, right, on these issues. And as far as the Secretary General goes, I cannot tell you if and when, but obviously it's a situation that is being watched carefully, and there is a tweet that was issued on Venezuela that, if you look at, in the chat on this, in this meeting, that's been issued by the High Commissioner. It's not like there haven't been any statements, but it's a space that I think perhaps merits being watched, and there may be something in the near future. Thank you. Thanks very much. Excellent. Great timing. Margaret is Catherine, if you're still connected, here's the response from Margaret, and then I think we have a question from Gorgi online.
So, Catherine, as I got my dates right, at least, the Regional Committee for Africa is going to hold a special session next week, 14 January 2025. The provisional agenda includes the item on the process. So it's purely they're still going to be discussing the process for nominating the Regional Director for Africa. There's a web page dedicated to the special session. It's available on the AFRO website. So go to www.afro.who.int to the About Us governance sessions. I can send that. I can put that in the chat, I think. Or can I put that in the chat? It's there.
Okay, great.
Is that possible?
Yeah, you can.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'll try
and send the link in the chat.
I'll send the link in the chat. Yeah. So you'll
send
have the link
in the
chat.
Send it to us and we'll add it.
See if my technology's up to it.
Thank you very much. I see, Catherine, you have your hand up again. Is that a follow-up?
Yes. So if I understand well, the process has not been decided yet. It will be decided on the 14th.
I turned myself off, sorry. Yes, exactly. So it'll be an interesting session.
Thank you very much. Monsieur Elhadji Gheorghi Wadi Ndoye.
Bonjour.
Bonjour.
Bonne heureuse année, Michele et tout le monde.
Carrément.
En fait, c'est concernant juste Venezuela. J'ai partagé avec vous dans le chat ce que le patron des droits de l'homme a dit, M. Walter Turk, c'est ça? C'est sur le chat, il vient juste de faire, mais malheureusement, c'est un tweet. Je pense quand même, Michele, pour un vendredi, nous avons le briefing. Au lieu de faire un tweet, ils auraient pu d'abord nous envoyer le message à nous qui sommes ici avant de faire le tweet, non? Mais bon, bref, l'information est là, madame peut regarder sur le chat. Merci.
D'accord, merci. Mais en plus, perhaps I'll say this in English, because there's also a statement from the fact-finding mission, you know, which I will put in the, you know, in the chat. So, you know, it's an additional link from the human rights pillar of the UN, in which the fact-finding mission condemns the recent arrests ahead of the presidential inauguration. So, and that's both in English and in Spanish. Is there another question, Maya? Go ahead.
My question is regarding what would be the economic impact on these social media platforms that explicitly disseminate hate if the UN and its agencies stop the paying for advertising and posting on them, because they spend millions of dollars. It was established by the UN Human Rights Council and investigators that the Rohingya were killed, tortured, and prosecuted, and this was played off on the Facebook platform that was well established. So when are we going to stop spending money and supporting these platforms that disseminate hate?
Well, I don't know about spending money, because, you know, I don't think that I stand to be corrected, but I don't believe that there's a whole lot of spending money on social media platforms on the UN side.
Excuse me, just a second.
I haven't finished. I'm sorry?
The stuff that you spend money on, that they are posting on every day, producing this content for these social media platforms that disseminate hate, they are paid. They have salaries of $200,000 a year. So, I mean, you are spending money on the social media platforms instead of supporting the news media.
Well, okay, sorry, but I disagree with the premise of what you're saying. We're not, one is, you said paid advertising, which is not something generally that the UN engages in.
Of course, you don't do just organic distribution.
Excuse me, I'm addressing your question, if you let me finish, okay? So, first, paid advertising, no. Secondly, if you consider that, you know, having people who are paid a salary to do work on social media, you know, is paying social media platforms. That's, you know, a bit of a leap, but, you know,
we have,
excuse me, if you let me finish, Maya, please. You have your turn. You'll have your turn. So, as we've said, our communication strategy continues to be engaged on these platforms and to offer you know, a UN perspective, right, on issues of common concern. So that's, you know, that may change, but for the moment, it's not the case. Did you have something to add? All right, thank you. Gabriela.
Sorry, Michele. I'm looking for the tweet that you mentioned that High Commissioner of Human Rights said about Venezuela something, but I can't find it. So if you can read it.
If it's in the chat here, but you know, I'm happy to send it to you directly if you want.
Because, yeah, I don't see anything.
Do you see the chat in the Zoom?
In the chat?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
I will go there. Okay. Thank you.
All right, thanks. John Zarkostas. Happy New Year to you, sir.
Good morning and happy New Year to you, Michele. Just to follow up to Maya's observations, I was wondering if there is a UN directive to ensure that press releases sent out by UN agencies contain the statements on issues, because what we've seen in quite a few agencies, the press release has the facts, and then you go into social media and the head of the agency has a comment on the content of the press release. Sometimes the head of agency is not quoted in the official press release we get through the email server for journalists. It'd be nice if it's harmonized, so what is on social media appears in the official press release.
I have to be honest, John, I'm trying to follow the argument. So you're saying that there's a press release and then there's a statement by head of agency that has issued that press release that perhaps, you know, and that content is not reflected in the press release. Is that correct? And you're asking whether there's a directive on harmonizing content between what appears in press releases and what appears on social media platforms. Is that the question? I'm sorry, I'm just trying to understand exactly what you're
the asking. Head of agency, the quote by the head of agency does not appear in the press release, and it appears on the social media sites, and that is the problem.
Right. Okay, I feel like maybe you have something specific in mind that you're not telling us about there, John, but I mean, to answer your question, there's no specific directive on this. It strikes me that it's possible that, you know, there's a press statement that is issued, and subsequently there may be a comment or a, you know, statement by the head of agency, and that then appears on social media platforms. But, you know, without knowing the specifics of what you're referring to, it's very hard to address. I don't know. Is there something specific that you wanted to, that has raised this issue for you?
It's just that the comment on the subject sometimes does not contain a quote from the head of the agency in the official press release.
Right.
That only appears in social media. So a journalist has to constantly go back and forth between the official press release and the social media postings. That's all.
Right. Well, you know, life is complicated sometimes, but yes, I will.
Yeah, but
you know, we'll try to. Did you have something to say on the matter,
Maya? I have something to add.
It's nice to raise your hand, and yeah, go ahead.
Actually, yes, I understand that some journalists are leaving Twitter as well because it's a very toxic environment. So people shouldn't be obliged to be constantly on the social media platforms that disseminate hate, you know, in order to gather information. Besides, there's the question now that AI will manipulate the image and sound, so you don't know. You have to double check to make sure that it's really Volker Turk saying something, you know. So I think the social media strategies should be reviewed in light of providing the news media with factual, trustworthy information.
Thank you. Look, I mean, you make a good point, and I think that, you know, the UN and our department has been working for a long time on issues of trust in media, right? And there is no doubt that, you know, on a number of social media platforms, there's a lot of hate speech, which we have been, you know, very vocal about. and that there is a sort of toxic information environment. You see this across a whole range of issues, right? So it's a legitimate position to have, and like I've said, we as the UN are watching that and cognizant of that and trying to call attention to the fact that there's a lot of misinformation and that there's a lot of we're actually victims of misinformation campaigns and disinformation campaigns, right? There have been sustained campaigns on social media against the UN or parts of the UN. And so we know what the issues are, right? That said, for the moment, and I cannot speak for the High Commissioner for Human Rights, it is the position of the United Nations Secretariat that we maintain our space on a number of these social media platforms, the ones that we're active on currently, because there are people who are looking for our information and for our voice as the UN on those platforms. And that may change, but at the moment we're maintaining this course. If there's nothing further, I'm going to wish you a delightful rest of the day and weekend. Thank you very much.